Hello, and welcome to episode 38 of All the Horrible Things with your super spooky hosts, Christopher Pagnozzi and Enan Joseph Hennigan. And we're here today to talk about Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Man, did I enjoy this. I think I can honestly say it was my favorite thing I watched over the Halloween month.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's a strong statement.
Yeah.
Where do you come from with Guillermo? Have you always been a longtime fan? Is there one that you like more than the rest of his?
The Mimic, which I think, you know, didn't get much or as much love as it could have been because
it had chops. And then he does Blade 2, which is as good as Blade 1, if I remember correctly. Blade 3, I remember sucking.
Yeah, Blade 3 is bogus. Blade 2 may have been, I think, my favorite of the trilogy.
There you go. It's not the one with Ryan Reynolds,
no,
right?
That's Blade 3. 2? That's 3.
Okay, where he comes in as Deadpool. And, of course, Hellboy's Pan's Labyrinth. He gets kind of fire in that zone.
The guy
what
loves
about Hellboy
monsters.
2? Were you into Hellboy 2?
I think so. No, certainly not as good as Hellboy 1.
I don't rightly recall it, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah. He's got a great body of monster work. Literal monsters. And, I've always been a fan. I think one of his best films is The Devil's Backbone. Did you ever see that?
I have not seen that one.
Great.
I need to watch that one.
Great.
Yeah, that's really scary, right?
Yeah, it's creepy. But
one thing that people don't talk about is The Strain. And when that first came out, the FX series The Strain about vampires, because Kronos was obviously a vampire film, which was his first one. And it looks as though the first thing he works on in television is The Strain, which is also vampire fare. And it was so cool, the visuals of like the vampiric parasite thing coming out of people's mouths and infecting. That was so unique. It was like part xenomorph, you know?
Yeah.
And I dug it.
I did too.
I really enjoyed
The Strain as well. I think
I didn't finish it though. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I watched the last season.
I don't think many people did. I think it had some trouble, you know, with momentum there towards the end.
Just fell off in quality, I think was the reality there.
Yeah.
But I'm also a fan, so I was excited going into this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was one of the better things that I watched over the Halloween month, but I only liked half of them.
Same.
So there's 8 of them, and I would say 4 are really exceptional, and 4 really missed the mark for me.
Yeah.
And today we're gonna rank them, of course, as we do. And of course, we have our own opinions here, so there'll be a little little hodgepodge and mix and matching as we bring up ones that might be in each other's list at different points.
Yeah,
but did you watch them all at once? How did you ingest these?
So I watched. It was an interesting release schedule. I kind of liked it that they were releasing them as a build up towards Halloween. They were doing 2 episodes at a time. I watched them in twos every night they came out. And at first I was a little confused as to how they were going to be released. I thought it was going to be weekly, you know, and then I was like, oh man, they're so smart. Give us new episodes every night leading up to Halloween. And
the 2 spot I kind of liked.
Yes.
Because it's like, then you get the amount of a movie, you know, because they're roughly an hour each. And interestingly, I felt like a lot of them had themes with the coupling with the duos that they actually kind of connected to each other more often than not. And I also saw like some connective thread throughout the entire beast, the entire anthology. I felt like there was a lot of overlap, certainly motifs and just the thematic stuff that was going on and what the characters wanted, the motivations of the characters, and even, you know, some of the imagery. We could talk about that, but
I completely.
Did you notice that at all? Or?
Yes. And I think that's why it worked as like an anthology. A lot of anthologies like have no connection. This worked. And I'd be really curious to see like if or how Guillermo approached this, because I guarantee, you know, he found the filmmakers he wanted to work with. Did he give them an assignment? You know, did he give them like, here's the world that these projects live in type of a thing, and something as simple as that might have been why they felt like there was a connection.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see that. When I'm looking here in terms of who wrote them, it looks like of the 8 he has Mr. Del Toro written only 2. Wait a minute. Yeah, was that right? Yeah, he only wrote 2, but it looks like he directed only one. So it's pretty generous to himself to say that they're his. These are all his curiosities. But he is our host. He's trying to do an Alfred Hitchcock sort of thing here.
Yeah.
The Crypt Master. I do like the metaframe. I do love the actual prop of the cabinet and him pulling out some sort of artifact that's related to the tale that's about to be told. Really dug that. And what did you think about the opening themes? The credits. I thought those were really cool too.
Yeah, and something else that I think was really cool, and maybe not a lot of people know this, but there are like individual posters for each film as well.
Yes.
And I think that's
awesome.
That's something that you can also remember is like, yeah, they have a connection in this world, but they are standalone films and they have really cool posters if you get a chance to look those up, like on IMDb.
And I would say 75% of the time, the production value was amazing.
Yes.
There were a couple where I was a little iffy on some of the creature design and such.
Yeah.
But we can talk about that as we go along. You want to dig into our least favorites?
Yeah, let's do it. As my least favorite, I saw this quick little interview with Guillermo del Toro talking to Mike Flanagan. I think Netflix may have put it out, where they were just, you know, talking about their upcoming projects, because Mike Flanagan had the Midnight Club, Guillermo's project was coming out. And the biggest difference is that Mike Flanagan directed, he wrote all of the Midnight Club and only directed, I think, two episodes. And okay. And Guillermo, the cool thing he was saying was that he really, really likes, maybe even more so than directing his own projects, he likes bringing these filmmakers together and almost like propping them up to be successful. And so when in that interview, he was talking about how he had inspired one of the stories about birds, and the way he described it sounded so cool. And I was very excited for it. And it ended up being my least favorite project, which was The Murmuring. And I think it's because
The Murmuring was my least favorite too, and we did not confer on our list prior to this.
No.
So we're finding this out as you do, which is I think probably shocking for a lot of watchers.
Yeah.
Because as I was looking at reviews myself, The Murmuring is like one or two on most people's list. And I don't know, are they just sucking up to Guillermo or the director?
Well,
who I expected. Okay, don't get me wrong. I want to say that The Murmuring's tone, visually, I loved it. I just didn't like the story. Story was what lost me. But Jennifer Kent is the director of this, and she did The Babadook.
Yes. And not only that, her main actor in this, Essie Davis, is the star of The Babadook as well. She's the mother from The Babadook.
I missed that. I don't know how I missed that.
Yeah, and you also.
Yeah. And then you got Andrew Lincoln from The Walking Dead,
yeah,
who I will say it was really fun to see him in something else. And I do think his like monologue, when he's kind of explaining how he feels, because it really revolves around loss and grief, because they lost a kid. Can you remind me at what point, how old was the kid that died?
So I don't know if they actually ever say the actual age, but I think we're led to believe that the child was probably not even a teenager. So probably around 9 or 10, I would say.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
Her kid, Claudette, their kid, Claudette, is going to be roughly the same age as the kid that is murdered by his mother in this house, which is on this secluded island, really kind of set off from all of civilization.
Great setting.
And she starts to see the image of the kid, hear the kid. Classic haunting action going on. And it's really kind of an unraveling of what happened in this house. And I didn't care. And the payoff, though cathartic, I don't feel like it felt more dramatic to me. It felt like what's the Nicole Kidman one where it's not that
the
scary.
Haunting
the Haunting
or the Others, sorry,
the Others,
the
thank
Others.
You thank you, where it doesn't get me like some of the other ones do. And I'm gonna be honest with you, I just can't relate, having not had kids myself. Maybe this would be much more affecting for someone with children or who has experienced loss like that. I could see it being very powerful for that. And granted, in Babadook, she dealt with grief again.
Mm-hmm.
So this is her ballpark, which makes sense why she did direct this one.
Yeah.
Apparently she did the tell. It's his based on his short story, but she did write the teleplay.
Mm-hmm. I actually think it was well written. I just think the subject matter and the relationship between the husband and wife and the fact right. that they're yes. And the fact that they are bird watchers. It sounded like such a cool pitch. And I think this I don't know if it was just kind of boring at times.
Yes. I think it was boring.
Yeah. And then the build up to the ghost.
It was visually pleasing, but it was like a lullaby. I did watch it before bed. I did get through it, I think. You know what? No, I didn't. I fell asleep halfway through it. I had to finish it the next day. You're absolutely right.
Right.
Some of these other ones did not do that to me, and I'd watch them right before bed. Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's the weakest, and everyone seems to just adore it. And I do love the imagery of like the birds and the flocks, the swarms.
Yeah, and the other thing I really love, and this is kind of another connection through the whole anthology, is that the different time periods and how it affects the character's relationship to whatever's happening. Like if it's a haunting, they have their bird watching devices, the film camera, the really cool audio. It almost looks like a phonograph record player that's, you know, kind of bouncing off sound. And I loved that. I loved how the technology was different in each story. And yes. It still wasn't enough to really.
No, I mean, when I'm thinking about my favorite moments, it might have been when she's confronting the man that they're renting the home from.
Yeah.
After he shows up.
Yeah.
You know. And she's been experiencing all these things. She's like, why didn't you tell me about this? You should have told us about what happened in this house. Frankly, I'm going to give him like the underdog performance of this because mm-hmm. the way he responded to her accusations and just like chastising.
Ungrateful.
Great.
Yeah.
Yes. She was coming off ungrateful. He's letting her stay at this house for free.
Sure. And it's haunted, but it's free.
Decades ago. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That was a really fun, tense exchange. And you got Andrew Lincoln looking from the window as he and his wife's relationship gets more and more strained and frayed.
But right.
I think it just, for me, it boils down to I could not relate with any of the characters.
I think that's,
really thought there was all the meat there to make it into something that mm-hmm. could have been scary. It just wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't there.
Yeah, and then the last thing I'll say about it is that I almost wonder, and this is going to sound weird, but if it had more time, because it's such a slow story, if it may have been a better like actual feature film that you could have explored more of like the actual haunting aspect of it. But
missed opportunities, like the whistle that they shared with each other.
Yeah.
That could have been used more effectively in terms of scares. And
yes.
the dead wife, the wife who killed herself, killed her
yeah.
child, could have messed with her way more.
Mm-hmm.
You see her at the end, like a bat out of hell coming at her down that hallway.
Yeah.
It's just more cheesy than scary. Maybe with more time, but I don't know how you sell this outside of an anthology. I wouldn't probably want to see that one in the theater based
right.
on the premise alone.
Although I still want to see more from Jennifer Kent because I really do think she's a fantastic writer-director.
I do too. What her second film, The Nightingale, I did watch and I did like that. Let's see what her future projects are coming up.
I was going to say, I also...
Nonfiction book, Alice and Freda Forever, apparently.
Interesting.
But yeah. I know she's super reluctant to
do
Babadook 2.
She'll never do a sequel to Babadook. And I respect that.
Which I do respect.
Yes.
Totally.
All right. Let's jump to our number... I guess this would be our number 7, the second least.
Yeah, what's your number 7?
Right now, I was thinking about like how a couple of these may kind of... They could flip-flop. But right now, my number 7 is Dreams in the Witch House. And I
Dreams in the Witch House.
Now
okay, that's not my 7. That one kind of came in a middling, but it is still in my bottom tier. So that's 5 for me. And like I said, I liked 4, didn't like the other 4. And this is one that I was okay.
Yes. And I think it's has a lot of the ingredients there. I really love stories about witches. I think it was a little late to get to the witch in this story. I think they spent a lot of time, setting up this, this realm of like how you move back and forth between
the
living and
of moving between the different dimensions.
Yeah, and they set and
was belabored.
Yes, yes, because the cast is fantastic. The performances are really good. I loved the witch and how she looked.
Exactly. Oh. In the way the Murmuring missed the visual of our main antagonist, this one nailed it. Might be one of my favorite visuals of all of these.
Yes,
was the way the witch was burning from within, yeah. And when she ran, like a fire being stoked by oxygen, like would flare up more. That was really cool. Really enjoyed that.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Was this one of the stories that was also based off of like an H.G. Wells? Because
yes, this is based off H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, sorry, it's Lovecraft. It was Lovecraft. And yes. It makes you really want to just go back and more read Lovecraft because the guy was like ahead of his time with horror.
Right.
You know, the thing, though, was that it was just maybe the second half. It was more exciting, but also kind of goofy with the rat.
With the rat with the human face on it.
Yes.
Just felt really out of place.
But here's the thing that, and again, I don't even think we should have to say spoilers, but the thing that really, got me was how they left it open. Like, you know, I love that in a horror story when, you know, like we're never going to see a sequel or a spinoff or whatever, but the way it ends with the rat crawling into him and basically ratatouille-ing him, he turns him into a puppet, which makes you want to.
That was cool.
Yeah. I thought that was fun. So that's how I felt. It was
very Pinocchio-esque, and that's another thing Guillermo has had his hand in.
Yeah.
He did his own version of Pinocchio, which I guess is probably one of the better ones. Certainly better than the one on Netflix everyone's trashing now, right?
I haven't seen it. That one's supposed to be.
Or Disney Plus, rather.
Right.
That's supposed to be really bad. But I think they dwelled too much on the addiction side of it, too, how he needed this drug.
Yeah.
It just felt like they were dealing with too many themes. Mm-hmm. And I got felt a little like messy. He was too old and mature to still be dwelling on his twin sister's death from decades and decades prior. Because what is Rupert? He's probably like mid-30s to 40 at this point. And
yeah, I'd say mid-30s.
When his sister died, we're talking like 10 at max. So it just...
It does come off a bit strange. Viable. Right. Right.
I couldn't really buy it. I like the relationship between him and his friend.
Yes.
I thought
from Lord of the Rings.
Business with the way to get into the world outside without the medicine sort of thing. When he's like you said, in the latter half, there's this stuff on the wall, these little pieces, and then you got to use the wand or whatever. Didn't like that. I like the also idea of the painting that foretold the future.
Oh yeah, that was cool. Interesting, that was really cool.
Part of it as well. That felt Lovecraftian. But this one was yes, it was paired with Pickman's model, which also deals with paintings having additional powers.
Right.
So right off of that, I kind of in that sense didn't like how closely related they were.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right.
I get why they were paired together, but it was like, give me something new, sort of. I don't want to deal with spooky, all-knowing.
What was your number seven then?
My number seven was, it could have been eight for me in terms of production value and such, because I like the way the Murmuring looks better than I liked Graveyard Rats.
No!
But I did not Graveyard Rats.
Yeah.
I really struggled with it. This one was only 37 minutes too. So it was much shorter than the rest. There is this one scene where he's trying to get out of owing this guy money, where he just rambles on and on.
Yeah.
Granted, they make light of it. He's like, I'm sure you don't want to hear me talk on and on about this. And I felt that way as the audience. I didn't like the character.
Yeah.
I didn't like the way the big rat looked. I didn't quite understand why the skeleton came alive underground.
Right.
Unless it was related to what was talked about with the black church, the dark churches underground.
Yeah, I want actually
like some sort of like. Go ahead. Yeah.
I wanted more information on that. I think that they just sort of like, and I'll get into it when I talk about Graveyard Rats, but I wanted more of it seems that there was like missing information when we're down there in that world, that we're, you know, there's like an altar and there's, yeah, the skeleton and like, wait. We only sort of like touched on that. There should have been a little bit more revealing of these churches yes. underground.
It felt very thin. It felt like a, are you afraid of the dark? Not a cabinet of curiosities to me, you know?
Yeah,
I couldn't take it seriously, especially when you bust out that mama rat. It was at first it was cool when you got a little rat suckling from its teeth, but then it would disappear like it does. That's not going to happen. It's not a magic rat. I don't know. I like the grave robber premise.
Yeah.
Granted, it's connected with the first one that was released, which is Law 36, which is more modern day grave robber, essentially.
Right.
So I did appreciate that connection. I just was claustrophobic in a way that wasn't effective. You know what I mean? I felt like I was ready to be eaten by the rats by the end of it.
All right. I get that. I'll talk about Graveyard Rats in a moment here. I have one more before I get to it, and my number six is Pikmin's Model, and
same. That's in the bottom of my barrel too. That's comes in at six for me,
and it was disappointing because I really like I think his last name was Barnes. The actor
Ben from, Barnes. Ben okay. Barnes. I really like Crispin Glover. I can't say that I know much about Ben Barnes.
Ben Barnes kind of broke out onto the scene from Westworld in season one.
Oh, fair. Okay.
And
which was sadly canceled this week. I'm super bummed about it. I know. Even though I haven't watched season three or four.
I haven't either. So I was waiting to catch up on all that. Now I don't know if I'll ever do it. But his performance in that I thought was really, really great, and I think you're going to see a lot more from this guy. I obviously love Crispin Glover as well. I really like the ideas here, but I don't know if I liked how it was, you know, delivered to us.
Totally agree, and it was also another Lovecraft one.
Right.
I don't know. Like, I like period pieces. I do, but...
For horror,
It was hard to glom onto this one in any way that was meaningful. I didn't really relate with the characters. Again, the only character that I liked was Pikmin, who was Crispin Glover, and it's mostly because it was seeing Crispin Glover again and how this man doesn't age or something. No. I don't know what the hell is going on with him.
Yeah, Dorian Gray.
He looks like he did paintings. George McFly still. And what I really did like about it was the paintings themselves, because the premise of this one was ultimately he's seeing these demons and dementors or whatever, and he's putting them on canvas, but they're real. They like live with him in one sense or another, because he's certainly not living in that house that he is at the end in the beginning. He's living in this crappy little studio.
Right.
So where were they then, sort of thing? Because at the end, he makes it clear that they've been living with me here this whole time. They're real.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Well,
where were they before?
I don't know. Do they come out of the canvas? I mean, I know. Again, I think there's just not enough information or missing information. I also called a couple things coming, like when the baby in the oven. I mean, I saw that coming a mile away.
A mile away, for sure. And her chopping her fingers. Yes. She's not turning around. Yes. You know that it's such a typical trope.
Yes.
I do like that you see a painting and it changes you. To me, it's like an old The Ring sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you're doomed upon an image striking your eyes.
I think that's great. It's going
to be irreversibly corruptive. That concept is great. And I think that probably goes back to Lovecraft. And like you said, potentially missing information that were you to read the story, it might be there and make more sense. And this is one of the instances that I mentioned that I didn't love the production, the costume, the makeup, the monsters,
right?
Creatures,
when we see the scary,
yeah, they were goofy, they looked like they're from Fraggle Rock.
you're right,
they didn't get me when the one comes out of the well.
I know,
he's got this scrot sack, looks like a big old scrotum coming out of his throat. It just felt a little goofy to me.
I wonder if there was art included with some of Lovecraft's stories, because I know like Lovecraft was big into the Cthulhu, right? And I Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I haven't seen his, I'm wondering if they were just doing the author justice, you know, by showing him what Lovecraft had come up with and it just didn't deliver for us. But
that could be. Yeah. Speaking of Cthulhu, has there ever been anything properly executed with Cthulhu?
I think
it's like a big sea monster god, right?
And I think it's mostly inspired things than actually.
Oh, okay.
You know.
All right. That's fair. Yeah, we talked about in that recent Marvel one, Werewolf by Night.
That dude, yeah, Man-Thing.
The monster in that sort of looks like a smaller Cthulhu.
Yes, correct.
But yeah, I didn't love this one. It's definitely the bottom of my barrel, too. You know, as much as I love Crispin Glover, I didn't like his Boston accent. Accents are notoriously hard to do. It wasn't not an example of when it was done right.
Yeah, it wasn't just that. It was almost like they were trying to like, well, what did the accent sound like in this year? And you're like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
don't do it. Too goofy. Didn't quite
do it for me. But that's interesting. Let's for a second. Did you ever watch Willard? Because we have that rat one that we just talked about. And then he's the controller of rats in Willard,
that's
right?
That's true. Something yes.
Like early aughts.
Yes.
Is that good?
No. And it was a remake too, I believe.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think for the most part we're agreeing on what's
in the bottom
lesser.
Four. Yeah, because Graveyard Rats was my next
one.
Sounds
like you have Graveyard in your top four though.
No. It was my next one. Oh, so counting down, mine was The Murmuring, Dreams in the Witch House, Pickman's Model, then Graveyard Rats. The thing that there are things that I liked about Graveyard Rats that maybe you didn't, but the thing that I love in anthologies is that you can get away with like killing off your main character and you know, I think Graveyard Rats kind of fits, the story fits perfectly into like an anthology, horror anthology story world. Like you could have seen this on Tales from the Crypt. I know I talk about that a lot. You know, the character, the greedy character who gets his comeuppance and I too loved the story of the graveyard robber type of a thing. I thought that was really great. But yeah, I think Nora and I were watching it, and Nora's like, that rat reminds me of the R.O.U.S.'s from Princess Bride, you know, like the.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, yes. It's like, yeah, it doesn't incite terror.
No, it was more fantasy than horror.
The thing that should have been the most terrifying about that, and they kind of do it, is claustrophobia. That should have been the real, right. You know, you're underground in a tunnel,
yeah,
and it's caving in.
When he pulls on the root and he gets stuck, that was scary. That was probably the scariest moment in the whole thing. When he's trapped between the skeleton and the rat, and then he, you know, manages to escape by knocking the boulder, crushing the rat. That was fun to see the rat get crushed. But I just hated the skeleton crawling after him without legs. It just was like, why don't you stomp the head and crush that skull?
Right.
You know what I mean? What are you scared of, sort of thing? But let's bust into four.
Right.
What is your fourth?
Well, I thought it was going to be more liked because I love the director. I loved Mandy. But The Viewing is my next film. And I think it was just because I don't think it really worked. And the characters were great. The buildup was great. The payoff was not great.
Leaving us hanging like that really pissed me off.
It just seemed like we don't know how to end this. So why don't we just get a shot of this new creature, whatever? I don't know. I really liked how it kicked off. I liked this idea that there's this secret like society. I didn't know it was going to be Peter Weller. You got RoboCop as the star of this. I really liked the character choices, the actors. They all had the supporting actors all were comedic actors. I thought Eric Andre was great.
That's what I really loved about it. I put this one as, should I give it away? Just my number two.
Okay. Yeah.
Because of the character development and the strange, suspenseful dynamic that is the majority of this one, I liked it. And granted, I talked about not being scared by stuff, but the stuff that I wasn't scared of before was right in your face. Birds that are carrying spirits, not scary. Big old rats and skeletons, not scary. This is, I was scared about the unknowing. To me, the unknowing is some of the scariest aspects you can explore in horror. And I felt like this did such an amazing job of creating that like dichotomy between Peter Sellers and his very strange doctor who doesn't speak very much at all. She was very kind of like mysterious in her own nature in a scary way.
Yeah.
But then, like you said, you had the rest of them that were all gathered there that are all comedic actors, really getting outside of their comfort zone. Mm-hmm. Of course, love Eric Andre, you could do no wrong. But Steve Aggie, I mean, I remember him from Sarah Silverman program, and this is not what I've seen before. First, I didn't even recognize him.
Well, time out and really quick. Course, have you watched Peacemaker on HBO? HBO Max?
No.
Okay, because he's fantastic in that as well, Steve Aggie. I'm really like that he's getting these really cool roles. So sorry, continue.
He's a delight to watch. And then of course Charlene Yee, I also like her. We have seen her in that zombie one with Drew Barrymore. Love that. Santa Clarita Diet.
Yeah.
She did good in that. Very kind of comparable role, I would say. Mm-hmm. But just I love the archetypal confluence. And then Peter Weller's ultimately expecting each of them to bring their own interesting approach and understanding or theorizing to this artifact or whatever it is that they show him. Essentially, it's like an egg, right, of sorts, some sort of...
Yeah, moon rock egg something.
Supernatural, yeah. I don't... Was it a space rock? Did he explain where it was found? I missed
think
that.
So. I'd have to rewatch it.
It is a meteor. It is a meteor.
Okay, I think there is some sort of alluding to the fact that, yeah, other people have looked at it, where it comes from. But... and I loved it. And I loved that. And I loved the buildup of that. I just think I would have really liked this if the payoff was just a little bit better, because it was cool. Like what happens to you? It was almost like Indiana Jones, right? It's like looking at
how all of their, their deaths kind of were matched with their archetypes, right? You have the psychic guy whose head explodes.
Yeah.
Steve Aggie's face just melts. Doesn't it? Isn't his the one that just melts off?
Yes,
he just melts off. And then you have the doctor who's like mysteriously seductress, and she goes up to the meteor and starts like fondling it.
Then
how she's touching this goo that's coming out of the meteor is like her fingers are then transported into her own face, so she's like massaging and destroying her own face by touching it. Thought that was cool. But then, of course, you have our two favorite characters, Charlene and Andre, escaping really, really baboon-like.
That was insane. That was insane.
And then them driving away so ridiculously fast and then having no sort of understanding of what they do afterwards. And then, of course, having this monster take over Peter Weller's body. I love that. I thought essentially it was like, oh, this is the blob now. Sweet. It's just going to start consuming things.
The blob
slash
the thing.
It was more like some of the other ones we've seen in this, where it's the Pinocchio effect. It's this possession.
Well, you know, the other element that I want to talk about as far as the storytelling goes is that how much drugs were introduced, alcohol and drugs were introduced. And when you do that, I mean, I'm all about it, but you have to wonder, is it enhancing what they're seeing? Like, do they really see that?
That's
so that's the thing that I was a little also confused about. But I mean,
I loved the progression too, right?
Oh yeah.
So you got Eric Andre, he's got his favorite cigarettes. You start with the cigarettes.
Yeah.
And now they move on to weed. Or no, then they moved on to this like really fancy whiskey that's super old.
Yes.
And has a ridiculous backstory to it. And then the weed, and then the cocaine.
Wait, wait,
and then
time out.
Peter Weller's own helping of it is just obscene and hilarious. I liked the progression, like the buildup. This to me was kind of like this strange, almost like lesson in how to build suspense.
And absolutely.
Multiple avenues to kind of like point to that.
When they first sit down, their favorite drinks are all there. Tea.
That's right.
I mean, it was a really cool progression. But then, yes. So when they're driving away in that car, they're like coked out of their friggin' minds. And so you just have to wonder, like,
Well, here's the thing.
It could
have been done purposefully, because with every high comes the crash. So we have this ridiculous buildup, and then the crazy climactic scene in the room when the meteor comes to life. And then you have the slowest being ever that, yes, can annihilate you, but it walks at a snail's pace. Could it have been like metaphoric of, you know, a high? Like you're immediately, you're crashed, you're not getting anything else.
Yeah.
You can't get better than a face melt, you know?
Right, right. And how everyone, reacts to things differently. I thought it was interesting that the meteor really starts to open up or react when Eric Andre blows the smoke into it. It's like, he tells him, and Peter Weller's like, no smoking in here. You have to put that out. And he's like, oh yeah, sorry. He's like, weed too? Yeah. Like, there's no smoking in here. And it's ultimately what sets this thing off. Like, oh, the thing that you didn't allow near it is what actually sets it off. So, I mean, yeah, there was some really cool things happening here. And again, I think I would have put it higher if I had like I don't know. And I mean, that could just be me rewatching it again and appreciating it even more and catching more things. But right now, knowing that like you're not going to see that monster ever again or what's going to happen.
For me, it's the quality of it is really going to come down to the consciousness of the drop at the end.
Yeah.
Or not, whether or not this was something that actually related to what had occurred structurally prior.
Right.
But yeah, the monster was pretty freaky looking though, right?
It was cool design.
The design and makeup in this one, a crap ton.
Yeah.
So yeah, my number two, your number four. Let me hit you with my third then.
Please.
See. My number three is not unlike what happens to Peter Weller's character at the end. It is the autopsy is my third.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right.
Yes. I know a lot. This is at a lot of other people's top of the list too. It's like one or two.
Yeah.
Loved it, but I did have questions where I guess it didn't get up higher than say the viewing for me. So hit him with the premise of this one.
As I of the autopsy.
Yeah.
So it's actually a really cool murder mystery story going on here. You have this character played by, oh my God, I just said his name. And this is funny because when I was pitching you on this series, I said,
Murray, baby.
Yes. F. Murray Abraham, who shows
love
up.
F. Murray.
Oh, he's so good. As this medical, I'm sure there's a better term for it, but he's the guy conducting the autopsy in this small town.
Coroner, is that what you call it? You figure out what's wrong with somebody?
Yeah.
Is that it?
I think he might be like a medical investigator too, though, because you have this small town, like a mining town, and it sort of starts off with this, you know, this tragic event where you see these guys down in the mine and you think they're going to get... And they see this thing jump on top of the elevator cage that comes up and down, and it sets off this bomb that you see rolling around. So you've got this small town sheriff trying to figure out what's going on, what happened, who did this, with the coroner now played by F. Murray Abraham. They've got a really great relationship too that goes back years. So you know that there's trust between them. What I'm about to tell you, this weird story, is insane, but I know you'll believe me because you've known me forever. And it's them trying to figure out what's going on. And the rest of the episode is the autopsy, going through each one of the cadavers to figure out what actually killed them down there. Because I don't think it was just the collapse of the mine. I put it up
as you noted, it's the murder mystery is kind of where it all starts from, because they find this body in the tree that has been like the skin has been.
Oh, right. I forgot about that scene in the forest. Yeah. Yeah.
This is the part where I had the questions, right?
Okay.
Because we have ultimately a body hopping alien here at the end. Okay. A very small being that lives within. And this is one of the reoccurring threads throughout this whole thing, throughout the whole anthology. But so he's in this character who throws the bomb at the end that goes down to the mine. He did this to his buddy who he met in the bar. This is the person that's in the tree without parts of his skin have been ripped off and he's completely desanguinated. There's no blood in him. So I'm assuming he had to kill this guy, A, because that guy knew that he was somebody else and now right. he's acting differently.
Impersonating.
At the bar, and that's how he possesses him.
Yeah.
But B, is it because this is where he understands the anatomy of humans to be able to then body hop inevitably into
Correct.
F. Murray, like he or try to body hop into F. Murray? Is that why he was all cut up? I wasn't clear on that. What was going on with...
Yeah, I think there's several things going on there. I think, yeah, part of it is understanding our what makes us up. I think there's also the creature trying to get inside of the body. I think that they learn... It's like the alien was doing its own autopsy and...
I see.
And ultimately draining all the blood because it like feeds... It survives off of the blood.
Right.
But I understand.
Okay, yeah, here's the second part of my question mm-hmm. to this aspect of it, because like you kind of rolled over it because what happens in the latter half is just so much more fascinating. But then the sheriff has two locals post up to watch the body that they put back there, essentially baiting whoever left it there potentially to come back.
Or yeah, a couple of hunters.
This murderer is going to come back. And then all we know is that these two guys that were left to watch are just gone. What happened to them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I don't think we're left to know, and maybe it's because
I guess it just doesn't matter. It just left a little bit.
I hear you.
What's the point of having them post up there? I mean, I guess it then gives the urgency to the sheriff to call F. Murray, Dr. Carl Winters.
Yeah.
It is interesting. We got to note that the sheriff's name is Craven, right? That couldn't have been a mistake.
Oh yeah, I think you're right.
I dug that. But yeah. The second half is so freaking good with F. Murray cutting into the bodies of the miners, trying to figure out what killed them, because they're assuming that it was a bomb, that they're looking for shrapnel, essentially.
Right.
But none of them have this. And
the fact that they've been drained from their blood.
Some of them have been drained of blood and others haven't. Those two guys that were posted up, they weren't down there, were they? Were they down there too? Were their bodies found down there? No.
Okay. No.
So can you remind me, why did some of them not have blood and some of them did? I was unclear on that aspect of it too.
I think it was in regards to where they were positioned in the mine.
I see.
They were closest to the actual alien was able to drain them to get his strength back.
Okay, so it was a matter of sustenance for him
mm-hmm.
to drain them. All right. I was a little unclear on some of that, but it didn't really matter because of how cool, especially this last sequence when he's getting confused why they're without blood, getting freaked out. And I love how he's recording everything, too, that plays such a large part into the
yes.
with his voice recorder. Because when did this one take place? This is
I think this was in 80s? The 80s. Oh, I thought this was in the 60s 70s? Because they're actually 60s, okay. recording onto... like 1-inch tape instead of like a tape recorder, like a handheld tape recorder.
Right.
Yeah. I think it was the 60s.
But then, of course, you have the body that threw the bomb down there, which turns out isn't a bomb. It turns out it's its ship. It's another meteorite, essentially, that acts as this alien ship that I guess has a self-destruct mode.
Right.
Is that what we're to take from it?
Correct. I think he even says we have to do that so there's nothing to be found of.
So there's no trace.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. I thought that was all good. And their conversations with one another when they're both lying on the table is so cool.
Yes.
What did you take from what happens at the end here?
I think my favorite part of this is that this alien has decided that it's really intelligent and it's much smarter than humans. And F. Murray Abraham, basically, while he's laying there, figures out how to defeat this thing. It's like a game of chess while they're laying down there. They're between their two bodies and the alien's trying to get in. And F. Murray Abraham decides to leave a message on his body, destroy his eyes. There's no way this, once you're in my body,
ears.
Yes, you won't be able to. So he has to go through this like this pain just to end it,
that is supreme horror. That moment where he has to like for reason,
however,
you know, it's not just gratuitous. There's a purpose behind gouging out his own eyes, stuffing that scalpel into his ears.
Something cool that you learn, though, is that, well, we know that the coroner, he's dying of cancer. And when the alien finds out, the alien likes cancerous blood even more than regular blood.
Right. That's so fascinating.
F. Murray Abraham's character has to sacrifice himself, but he knows he's dying anyway. So I think there's that a little bit of relief. Yeah, it makes it a little bit easier for him to decide that. And then, you know, leaving that message for his friend, that was the ultimate thing. You know, he has to save his friend who has a family. And yeah, I thought it was really original. You know,
completely agree.
Yeah.
Yes. The way that it was all executed was pitch perfect. Who's this? So that interestingly, this is David S. Goyer, who had a lot of credits in terms of screenplays.
I mean, he wrote The Dark Knight, I think, right?
Yes, he did write The Dark Knight. He's prolific, put it that way. What else he got? I mean, granted, he wrote Dawn of Justice, he wrote Terminator Dark Fate.
Yeah, not all wins.
That genius movie with Timberlake, Jumper. But he does have Batman Begins and The Dark Knight under his belt, so this guy knows what he's doing. And he did Blade 2, so that's probably his connection then.
To Guillermo.
Mr. Del Toro.
That's cool.
You're right. It was totally original. I was on the edge of my seat throughout the entire thing. It looked beautiful, too. It's hard to make scenes interesting that are just in a sheriff's office, two guys talking to each other. Those were always interesting.
Yeah.
And then to be stuck just in the morgue for a big chunk of this and still be fascinating in these kind of confined spaces.
Mm-hmm.
It did well doing that.
Yeah. And that was something else that was really cool, is because this town is so small. They don't even have like a normal morgue to accommodate the amount of bodies that they have. So they had to like cold storage this location, which is something they had to do, like even in Chicago, like the turn of the century, that like going into the 1900s. When, do you ever hear about the ship that tipped over in the river, Chicago River, and all those people were inside of it and drowned?
Yeah,
their bodies were moved to several locations in Chicago that were turned into coolers to make sure. Wow. Yeah, it just people were pretty clever back then.
Yes. Yeah. No, it resonated with me. It stuck with me.
Yeah.
So essentially, we only got two left on our list to talk about, if you're willing to move on from this one.
Right. Yeah. And I will say The Autopsy is my number two. So
it's your number two.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess between, because we got two left. We got Lot 36 and The Outside.
Yeah.
Of those two, I'm going to guess Lot 36 is your number one.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And The Outside is my number one.
Oh, crazy.
So, yeah, let's talk about The Outside. So this is your number two. This is from a director I'm really interested in seeing more from.
Okay.
Because I saw a preview for Mona Lisa and the Blood Moon. Have you seen a preview for this one? It just looks so bonkers and cool. That's like at the top of my to watch list right now. It takes place in New Orleans. It's like this girl who's in a straitjacket with special powers going around the streets of New Orleans. That's all I really know about it. And it looks like she's going to be doing the next cliffhanger, which is weird.
Wow.
But this one for me made my number one spot, just because you got the feminist issues going on here and just beauty issues that I feel like, in terms of what is the most powerful message for who's watching this on Netflix, this is the one that might actually get through that metaphor, that underlying meaning more. Not to mention, I love the aesthetics. Since it was in the 80s, it was Christmas time too. It was so familiar. Yeah. I felt like I knew that scene. I knew their house. I knew the women that she was pretending to be friends with that worked at
the bank
with her. The bank at Christmas time. I feel like I've seen that in a lot of Christmas movies too. Certainly, It's a Wonderful Life. And there's Gremlins. This movie with Mary Steenburgen.
Yeah.
One Wonderful Christmas or something like that. Wonderful Christmas.
Gremlins has
this
a
magic
bank
Christmas
scene, though. Yeah.
With Mary Steenburgen. It's a really underrated Christmas movie.
All right.
but what? Have you seen that one?
No.
One Magic Christmas? It's pretty good. But her husband gets killed in the bank when he's pulling out money. And then it's anyways, this is not Christmas time. So let me focus back on The Outside. But the TV talking to her, loved this.
Dan Stevens
talking to, you pronounce it Kate McCucci?
Yeah.
They make her look unattractive in this.
I know.
Because she's not, you know, in real
she's
life.
Adorable.
She's adorable. But
Garfunkel and Oates, such a fan.
Yes. you could see why she was insecure and felt like she wanted to keep up with the women at work who were so vain and just so shallow. And then it boils down to her miraculously getting invited to this Christmas party, which she normally doesn't, and caring enough to go and then shoot a duck and stuff it because she's a taxidermist too. Such interesting character stuff is going on here, even with her husband, who's a
Martin
cop.
Stark,
he's made
yeah.
very well-rounded and interesting as well. But then, of course, just to, you know, not bury the lead here, the goop makes her into this hideous being before it comes alive itself in something that's a lot like Annihilation, if you've seen it, where it kind of mimics her in this very cool basement scene where there's enough of it that she's bought that it actually comes human size. I thought it was going to suck her in, but they went a different route with it, which I didn't mind because she then bathes in the bathtub with it.
Right.
And then here's my question for you. Is that her that comes out of the bathtub?
No.
She's gone.
I don't believe it is. I believe she's completely replaced. Also, have you seen the movie The Stuff from like 1985?
No.
It's about a mysterious goo that like comes to Earth and it's marketed to like really? for beauty. Like no, sorry, not beauty. Oh. For dessert. But it's like, you know, it's that old snake oil thing where this is a cure-all. And no, I don't believe it's her anymore. And I think we sort of get that idea like that she's like shedding her skin like almost like a snake throughout, which is brilliant because you could even you see her pain and she's continuing to do it just for beauty to feel. And that's the brilliant part about the title of this short is also it's not just about you know, the beauty on the inside. And even the husband says you're beautiful on in the inside.
Right.
It's also about being on the outside of society and looking in those women that she thinks she wants to be friends with who are terrible, who are all just talking about setting up their relationships for divorce. You know, just
how their boobs look good. Yeah. The guy they're having an affair with has a sizable member.
Yeah.
Has really skin deep stuff. You
yes.
know? It's,
yes.
When they're all horrible.
And she was the most interesting character that, you know, aside from how she actually felt about herself, was there was absolutely nothing wrong with her. She was incredibly charming, although I'm not a huge fan of
the teeth. She probably should have seen a dentist. The teeth is the one thing I might suggest she do something about.
Sure. But the thing that was the strangest about her was the taxidermy. And I think that's another thing that they're showing you is that, you know, she, I think, kind of dies also. And then the whole idea of keeping something alive once it's dead
really
by stuffing it is this, you know, overall what happens to her is that she is now like
she's
this.
She's empty now inside, similar to how she has gutted all of the animals. That's good. I missed that connection, but that makes a lot of sense.
All the good that was on her inside is now gone. It's outside of her body. And I just thought it was brilliant. Also, the director, if you've never seen A Girl Walks Home.
That's the Iranian one, right?
A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. And it's really, really great. But that's the same writer, director as this.
I haven't seen that. I need to.
Definitely check that out. I thought she did such a fantastic job with this. I thought
there was something about Dan Stevens talking to her as this, like, I don't know, Norwegian, some sort of.
Yeah, whatever he was. Yeah.
I don't know what his accent was.
Yeah.
But it's such a trope you've seen before where the TV talks to her. But for some reason, this one was just more effective than other times I've seen it. I struggled when she – it was such a fun scene when she kills her husband.
Oh, I know. Just when you thought like –
didn't quite get it at first. I mean, it makes sense if she is being gutted slowly. Oh, my gosh. What a great sequence that was.
I know.
As a whole.
I know.
And even when he like pulls the scalp out, he's still talking to her like, is it bad?
Yes. It was very comical. And Martin Starr is such a brilliant comedic actor as well that
So apparently based on a web comic by Emily Carroll. So
oh, really?
Kind of an interesting tidbit too. Yeah, so I dig that. That's kind of strange, considering the rest of them. But yeah, that's my number one. The only thing I wanted to mention less about this is, what did you make of the ending? So she comes into the bank. She's looking good. She's all gussied up. All the other women are like, what the hell happened? And now she's the Queen Sheba.
Yeah.
But what's strange about it is how long it just sits on her there at the end.
Oh, this
smiling at the camera, smiling at us.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
I think just my initial thought is that there's a couple things. It's almost like, is there a part of her still alive on the inside that's fighting this new version of herself? Is it that we're not supposed to necessarily recognize her anymore, and that her face is still changing? It's not comfortable for her to now, you know, make a just even like a smile. I think it has a lot to just do with like this new identity. But I'm sure there's other things there that I
think it could also connect to, similar to how she was being talked to through the screen.
This
quest for unattainable beauty and perfection is now, she's hitting us with it. We are now the ones. It is attainable. Look what happened.
Yes.
Am I just remembering wrong, or does she start floating upwards?
I think it's an illusion that's a camera trick. She could be. That's a great question. I would definitely watch that one again.
Same. Definitely. But let's talk about your number one, Lot 36.
Yeah.
It was all downhill for you after that first episode, then, if this was your number one.
Well, that's, you know, that is interesting, because I you know, you want to play sometimes with the series, if it's not like a pilot necessary, you do put like your one of your best episodes up front to hook people, and then you expect things to just, you know, kind of keep going and building and building. I think there's also that romantic side of the idea of finding something new, that you like the first thing you watch of it. I really liked just the way this set the tone for the series. And I mean, Tim Blake Nelson's so great. You don't get to see him as the lead, except for that Western they did a few years ago on.
It was the Coen Brothers movie.
Yes, which
I liked it.
Again, he was brilliant. He's not a likable character in this, and that's something else I really like anthologies is that
racist,
you know. Oh, he's terrible.
Bigoted,
he's terrible. His
greedy.
His only saving grace is that, you know, he served the country, and I think it changed him. I think it changed his look. He even says the only color in our unit was green or something along those lines. But the thing that I loved about this story was that, you know, there is a whole world. I mean, there's a Storage Wars TV show. You know, this is a real, you know, group of people who buy up units. I think this thematically had the greatest story. I mean, kind of like the graveyard rats of you know, somebody's greed ultimately being their demise.
Certainly, but in terms of what's going on with our economy and stuff right now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, corporations, inflation is due to their corporate greed sort of stuff.
Yeah,
I think it had a timely message.
Well, it had a timely message, but on purpose. The very first thing you see in this episode is footage of like Desert Storm. You know, in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And what I think that's just what they're trying to tell you is that, you know, we really haven't come that far as a country, as a people. We still have a lot of the same evil. We still have trouble, or there's a large amount of people who have still trouble treating others as the same, as equals. And then there's just the whole selfishness of our society. And this man thinks he deserves what he's purchased. You know, it's that whole idea of an American who, this is my property. This is, I earned this. Or because you aren't a good American, you don't deserve it. So like the poor woman who has lost her family storage unit because because the guy even admits, I didn't give you the proper like heads up. It's now Tim Blake Nelson's like, sorry, mine, dibs. And it's just a terrible reflection of like of our society. Then there's a really cool story about this demon. Like what should be your A story kind of feels like it's the backdrop of what's going on in this episode. It's this really cool story about this man who, well, basically a Nazi who is got these demon books. Who
on the seance table.
Yes, and he conjured a demon and it possessed his sister and he keeps her trapped and locked up. I thought that was so great.
Yes, and the guy who wants to then buy this last book and goes back to the storage unit with him, he is fun.
He was great.
Even though, yes, he probably does have some sort of
terrible ties. Nazi pastor, yes.
As alluded to. It's just when he's trying to reason with the character Nick, like, okay, if it is here and there a demon does arrive, just don't look him in the eyes. And Nick's like, don't tell me what to do. No, it's just the way that they interacted. That was the comedy in this one. But yeah, what did you think then when the demon is shown? I thought it was really cool. I really like this demon.
Oh yeah. Tentacles. Tied to the floor almost, like it needed like new life just pumped into it. I thought the visuals were awesome. I liked that little room. I liked that creepy winding hallway where they kind of set that up, which is describing this building and how he says his unit that he just purchased should be a little bit deeper. So good. So good. And
yeah, it was amazing. And the tentacles is something that pops up in a few of them because the autopsy, the alien certainly has tentacle-like structures that we have in the Lot 36 monster. There's another one I want to say. Oh, yeah. Even the monster in the viewing at the end when he takes over Peter Sellers, that has tentacles as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that one I mentioned, like, imagery kind of repeating.
Absolutely. Are they somehow connected? Is that thing from another planet? Not really from another planet. Is it just like a demon, you know? It's just metaphors left and right. Our own demons. I think this one really nailed it.
And the way Amelia gets her... sweet, sweet revenge by not letting him out, keeping him trapped in Lot
36. Love that. Yes.
He gets snarfed. Dug it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was definitely up there for me as well. It made my top four. So I just think it's really interesting. We both agreed the four that
hit
and the four that didn't.
Yes. I think.
I think that's a good sign.
I completely agree. And then just like maybe the balance of these should have been mixed up. A little bit more because the murmuring is almost like ending on a bad note, you know, or not hearing the end of a song.
Bad note.
Yeah. That could have been like episode 3.
I think there's going to be a season 2.
I guarantee it. That was just too much fun.
There's not. And of course we just found out this week, there's going to be season 2 of Sandman.
I know.
Next summer or whatever.
I know. And I think if I remember correctly, the way we ended up ending that podcast was saying, I think it deserves a second, you know, season to just work things out.
It took
out.
A while for them to do it, but it's happening.
Yeah.
So I am pumped about that.
Yeah.
I'd say thumbs up to Cabinet, especially if you're a horror fan, watch them all. If you only got 4 hours to spare, watch The Outside, The Viewing, The Autopsy, and Lot 36, and you'll be good.
Good call.
But until then, stay alive.
Stay alive.